Call the meeting of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. Begin with first order of business be the minutes. We need to have a motion to approve the minutes from February 17th to reflect an author's amendment that was overseen or overlooked the first time. So, excuse me. Do we have a motion to Representative McDonald? Would you be so kind as to move that motion?
I'd be delighted to. So moved.
All right. Any discussion? Okay, all those in favor of the minutes from February 17th, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And approved. We need a motion for the minutes from February 18th. Representative Pawlowski, have you moved the motions lately?
I can, yes. Definitely.
Would you like to do it?
Happy to do it.
Okay. Representative Pawlowski moves the minutes from February 18th. Any discussion? Did you have a question, Representative?
Mr. Chair, I forgot to make note that the minutes on February 17th is 1 month from the St. Patrick's Day, March 17th.
That's good. Good to know. Good to know. You want to restate your motion? We kind of lost track. Motion is to approve the minutes from February the 18th. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 And the minutes are approved. Today is Minskew's Day in our committee. We have a number of testifiers, I think, that will be taking part in this, and I'm not sure who's starting. Chancellor Rosenstone, I'm sure, is. And Trustee Vickich, are you up first?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Identify yourself for the record and proceed, please.
Thank you, Chair Norris and members. Thank you for the opportunity to visit with you today. For the record, I am Michael Vickich, and I am the treasurer and chair of the Finance Committee of the Board of Trustees of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. As you both know, to my right is Chancellor Rosenstone. I would like to take the opportunity, Mr. Chair, just to identify the trustees that are here today, and I ask them to stand as I identify them. Chair of the Board, Tom Rainier. Trustee Kelly Charpentier-Berg. Jay Coles. Don Erlinson. And Bob Hoffman. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our legislative request this year is very clear-cut. We are asking for resources to protect the quality of our programs so that our graduates are prepared to meet the needs of the communities across the state. Today we will be asking you to consider a $142 million request, and that is to cover inflation, a tuition freeze, and to ensure prosperity for all Minnesotans. As a reminder, our mission of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities is to provide an opportunity for all Minnesotans to create a better future for themselves, for their families, and for their communities. We play an essential role in ensuring Minnesota maintains its well-earned asset of a highly educated citizenry, and to make sure that the education is affordable and, most importantly, accessible also. Although the lion's share of our requests and our revenues come from the state as well as tuition, we also work with some very important partners to support our programs and our students. I would like to take this opportunity to introduce you to one such donor. With me here today is Angie Wardell. And Angie, would you please stand? Thank you. Angie is the operations director at Graco Incorporated, a Minnesota-based company that serves customers around the world in the areas of manufacturing, process, construction, and maintenance industries. Also here today with me are Hennepin Technical College President Cecilia Cervantes, and also the interim president at Minneapolis Community and Technical College, Avelino Mills Novoa. Thank you. Both of whom can attest to Graco's partnership with their colleges. Graco's summer internship program with our students creates a pathway that strengthens their connection to industry as they complete their studies. Many machinists have been hired at Graco from Hennepin Tech and MCC over the years. And thanks to the Graco Foundation, the machine tool technology programs at Hennepin Tech and MTCT have recently received a donation in excess of $100,000, providing students in high demand field of the opportunity to train on the actual machines that are used in the industry. Graco also supports scholarships that allow students to study for a career that has tremendous opportunity for their growth. Two students who are unable to be here today, but I'd like to identify Michael Esposito and Sophia Cosisto. Both Michael and Sophia are students at MCTC's Machine Tool Technology Program, and they were recently chosen to receive $3,000 grants. I ask these fine folks to join us today to give you a glimpse of the people who are partnering with us to ensure a 21st century workforce for Minnesota. You have seen the words that comprise our mission, but here's the picture that's in front of you here. We educate all of Minnesota, with most of our students, nearly 6 out of 10 students enrolled in outside of the metro area. Like you, we are charged with serving the state from Ely to Worthington and all points in between. All people in all corners of the state. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to make some introductory remarks, and with your permission, I'd like to turn it over to Chancellor Rosenstone.
Thank you for your part. Now, welcome, Chancellor Rosenstone, and you want to grab one of those microphones?
Got it right here.
There you go.
Chair Nornes, a member of the committee for the record. My name is Stephen Rosenstone, and I'm Chancellor of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And I, too, am very much appreciative of the opportunity to spend some time with you this afternoon. As leader of the state's college and university system, a system that educates 6 out of 10 of the state's undergraduate students, nearly 90% of whom are Minnesotans, I feel a tremendous responsibility to the people of Minnesota. Minnesota State Colleges and Universities is made up of people who care about the future of our state. And many of our leaders are here today. In fact, I'd like to ask them to stand and remain standing as I recognize them. You were introduced by Trustee Vekic to each of the trustees that are in the room, but I'd like to ask them to stand and please remain standing once again. We're joined by a number of our presidents who I'd like to also invite to stand as I call their names and remain standing. Central Lakes President Larry Lumblad, Cecilia Cervantes, who was introduced, President of Hennepin Tech, Avelino Mills Novoa, MCTC, Joyce Esther from Normandale Community College, Robert Musgrove from Pine Technical College, Leslie McClellan from Rochester Community and Technical College, and Scott Olson, President of Winona State University. We're joined today by, in addition to our presidents and members of our board, by our faculty leaders and staff bargaining unit leaders. I would like to ask Jim Grabosco, I think is here, to please stand. If not, we have a representative of the IFO here. Adam Klepetar, President of Minnesota State University Association for Administrative and Service Faculty, please rise. Kevin Lindstrom, President of Minnesota State Faculty College. June Clark, President of AFSCME. Jerry Jeffries, President of MAPE. We're joined by leaders of our two student associations, Kaylee Schoonmaker, President of Minnesota State College Student Association, and Sarah Burns and Jared Weber with the Minnesota State University Student Association. Chair Nornes, members of the committee, we stand together behind the proposal that you will consider today. It has the support of all 5 of our bargaining units, both of our student associations, all 30 of our college and university presidents, and of course the endorsement of our Board of Trustees. And I want to take this moment to just thank these leaders for being here today and being part of the process.
On behalf of the committee, I'd also like to echo that and thank you for taking time to be with us this afternoon, and we're looking forward to the testimony.
We, you and I, and this team of leaders, we are responsible for delivering an extraordinary education to our students that is affordable and accessible. Together, we change lives, the lives of students across Minnesota. We change the lives of students like the ones you had a chance to meet last month at St. Paul College. You remember the extremely moving testimony of Heather Christopher, who described in great detail her education that is a key to a better future for herself, for her husband, and her six sons. You remember students like Ivan Martinez, a veteran, who told us about his experiences as a first-generation college student. These two students, of course, are just two examples of the over 410,000 students we are serving this year, that we have the honor to serve this year. But their stories are not unique. Each of our students has a story to tell about how higher education changed their lives and changed the lives of their families. As we discussed last month, this is a critical moment in the history of our state. It's a moment when our demographics are changing dramatically. It's a moment when education is more important than ever, when fully 74% of all the jobs in Minnesota are going to require some post-secondary credentials. It's a moment when access to an affordable education is crucial to the success of communities across our state. We must answer these big questions together. It's up to all of us to meet the challenges that Minnesota faces. And it's how we are all going to be remembered, all of us, together. We are also here to tell you that we have heard you loud and clear. And we look forward to answering your questions about enrollment challenges, administrative spending, and how we're trying to keep higher education accessible. But beyond the questions and answers, we must find a way to work together to solve two big challenges. First, how do we protect the programs that are essential to serving our students and serving regions across Minnesota? Programs that allow students to be prepared to serve their communities and ensure a vibrant workforce. Programs needed not just for their prosperity, but for the prosperity of businesses and communities across our state, and ultimately programs essential to the prosperity of Minnesota. And second, how do we continue to protect affordability? To walk you through the math behind our request, I would like, with your permission, to introduce Vice Chancellor and Chief Financial Officer, Laura King.
Welcome, Ms. King, and identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Laura King, and I'm the Vice Chancellor for Finance and the Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Chair Nornes and members of the committee, our approach to the 2016-2017 budget request begins with the fact that our colleges and universities receive over 90% of their revenue from two principal sources: from the taxpayers of Minnesota through this state budget process in the form of state support, and from tuition and fees. The central tenet of our request is to seek the right balance between the state's investment and what we ask of students in tuition. As this chart shows you, as the state has reduced its support for higher education, students have borne higher and higher shares of their costs. In 2012 the state provided 66% of the cost of education. Today, that share is 44%, a decline of one-third. As Trustee Vekic stated in his remarks, we are asking for $142 million in state support so that we can avoid asking students for another tuition increase. We are not asking to return to the 2002 levels of budget support, but rather to move towards a 50-50 financing plan, with the state providing 50% and our asking students to provide the remaining 50%. Our request, if fully funded, would move us to 47.5% in state support by 2017, an improvement from the 44% where we sit today. This approach would enable us to hold down tuition while continuing to protect access to high-quality, high-value education across the state. Our request of $142 million will allow our colleges and universities to continue playing the absolutely critical role in meeting challenges facing Minnesota. The funding would protect programs on all of our campuses so that we can continue to serve students and to meet the future workforce needs of Minnesota. It would protect our ability to deliver those programs, and it would protect our commitment to affordability to ensure access to all Minnesotans. The $142 million request will provide sufficient revenue to enable us to provide for a compensation increase and the cost of operations, inflation in operations on our colleges and universities. $142 million will only cover inflation. Our colleges and universities would have to find internal resources to fund any other costs that they face in their budget. What you see in this slide is a biennial number, which is the number that represents a 2016 base increase plus a 2017 base increase. At your place today, you have a copy of the campus impact document that we prepared to help you show the impact and the opportunities that our campuses face in thinking about 2016 and 2017. If you aren't able to find it at your place, please let us know and we'll make sure that you get it. You will see, for instance, in that document, on the third page, Alexandria Technical and Community College, this request represents a $2.1 million increase to that college to support basic inflation costs. The college has worked very hard these past several years to balance its budget with a 5% enrollment decline since 2011. You also see on the next page illustrated what this request means for Anoka Technical College. The $142 million request represents a $2 million increase to Anoka Technical College to cover basic inflation costs. The college reported a $900,000 deficit at the end of 2014 and has worked very hard this past year to bring their budget into balance and to launch new enrollment strategies. There's nothing in our $142 million request that would do anything for them for that $900,000 deficit. We expect them to solve that themselves this year, and they're working very hard to do that. The campus impact document illustrates both the scope and the scale of our colleges and universities and the tremendous passion they have for moving into the future with exciting new programs and student services. It also helps to show how close the finances are at our colleges and universities. I will have more to say about the impact on our campuses in just a few minutes, but first I'd like to share with you three issues that are relevant to our request. They relate to revenue, affordability, and efficiency. As was mentioned briefly in our introduction, we have only two principal sources of revenue: state support and tuition. Our board has done a tremendous job managing those resources and managing and advancing their commitment to keeping higher education affordable. We have done so in part by being extremely efficient. So allow me, if I might, to just address each issue in turn. The first issue concerns our principal revenue stream. What you see here is total revenue per FYE from 2012 to 2014. If you add state support and tuition revenue together, as this slide shows, you will see two very important trends. First of all, tuition revenue has increased while state support has decreased. And the combination of the two has hovered around $7,200 per FYE every year for the past 10 years. We have certainly raised tuition. We've held spending per FYE flat. And while tuition revenue has replaced some of the state reduction, it has not replaced all of them. So while there's certainly lots in the news about rising tuition, and that information is accurate, it has not fueled increased spending at the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. It has replaced some of the lost state support. Our colleges and universities have held their costs constant. Our budget request would enable us, with your help, to freeze tuition to the benefit of 264,000 students across Minnesota. With state support, tuition will remain constant at 2012-2013 levels. A university student would save $205 a year, and a college student would save $145 a year. A full-time university student over the course of their degree, if we add the current biennium's freeze to next biennium's freeze, would save over $2,000 in the cost of their degree, and a college student would save nearly $500. State support for our colleges and universities has increased significantly during the 2014-2015 biennium. But as this chart shows you, even with the recent boost in state support, funding remains 32% below 2002 levels, or 9% below without adjusting for inflation. Keep in mind that our colleges and universities are not funded on the basis of enrollment. While our enrollment was skyrocketing, state support was declining. Enrollment grew 15%, or approximately 18,000 students, between 2012 and 2014. And state support during that period was reduced by 35%. Enrollment is now forecast at 139,000 FYE, which is 7% above our 2005 level and 12% below our peak in 2011. Colleges and universities have cut their budgets to manage the enrollment decline. Pardon me one second. This table illustrates the second issue that I'd like to bring to your attention, and that is just how affordable our colleges and universities have been and will continue to be. The table shows gross undergraduate tuition and fees as a percentage of median family income. And by gross, I mean tuition and fees before application of any financial aid that a student might receive. I think you may have seen this chart before. We use it because we think it tells a very powerful story. As the chart shows, the state college percentage tuition and fees of median household family income has been essentially flat since 2011 and has increased less than 1% since 2005. State universities, likewise, have increased less than 1% since 2009. We know that financial aid lowers this number in households that receive financial aid. Keep in mind now, as you're looking at this chart, that these numbers represent tuition and fees in the face of a 32% decline in state support. And that tells us that tuition revenue has increased and total revenue per FYE has gone down. It tells us our colleges and universities have controlled costs in order to manage increasing pressure on affordability, and it tells us they've done that while there's been a sharp decline in state support. Our colleges and universities are the low-cost option in the market. That is who we are. And with your help, we can continue to provide an opportunity for all Minnesotans by protecting affordability and the quality of our programs. Affordability is a key differentiator for us and one worthy with your help of our protection. You have seen this chart before. It shows that all colleges and universities in Minnesota, if you notice on the left, the green lines indicate our colleges and universities. all the Minsky colleges and universities, and the red lines indicate everyone else in Minnesota, the other institutions. And you'll notice that the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities are way to the left on this scale. We are the most affordable option in Minnesota, and we really need to stay that way. The third issue relevant to our request is administrative efficiency. Part of our commitment to protecting costs is protecting affordability by holding down administrative costs. Administrative spending by the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities consistently ranks among the lowest in the nation. In fact, we rank 38 out of 50 states in the District of Columbia in administrative spending per student. Administrators account for slightly more than 3% of all employees. That's 550 employees out of 18,000. The number of administrators system-wide has declined 4% since 2009. When you think of the average person working at the system office, consider that fully 60% of the system office budget and 40% of our system office employees are dedicated to providing IT services to students and staff across the system on every campus. This includes IT systems that support students with registration, online courseware, course management tools. 59% of our system office employees are members of MAPE, supporting campuses and students across the state. So when a student logs on to register while sitting at their kitchen in Grand Rapids, they're logging on to a network that the system office maintains, to a server that the system office maintains, to courseware and registrationware that the system office maintains. So that work happens in St. Paul to the benefit of our 400,000 students across 400,000 kitchens in Minnesota. Our efforts these past years have been to work with our campuses to build more and more tools to help them save costs. We continue to develop services through the Campus Service Cooperative. Our IT group is working with campuses to streamline and further secure campus data systems, and campuses are working together in new ways across the system to control costs and increase efficiency. I'd like to turn now, if I might, to the impact of the request on our campuses. Our colleges and universities vary in size, from 275 FYE to 13,900 FYE, and they range in budget from $3 million to over $200 million a year. No matter the size of the student population or the overall budget, the financial profile is similar at every college and university. What's at stake is protecting these programs across the state. Our colleges and universities dedicate 75% of their budget to payroll, and those costs are determined by collective bargaining contracts. The other section that you see here on this graphic includes things like utilities, supplies, and equipment. Our labor force is 93% unionized, showing on the right-hand chart here. Faculty unions represent 59% of our employees, and AFSCME and MAPE represents an additional 32% of our employees. These, of course, are statewide unions negotiated on a statewide basis. Recall earlier that I indicated our request provides inflation for both the traditional state support and in lieu of a tuition increase. As this chart shows, if there is no additional state support provided, and if tuition rates are frozen for another 2 years, we would have no ability to fund inflationary costs through any other means. We would be cutting budgets, we'd be reducing staff, we would have no other option. That would be in addition to cuts already necessary by our campuses to absorb enrollment declines. I promised to say more about the impact on our campuses, so at this point I would like to invite two of our chief financial officers to share with you what our campuses are trying to do to protect and serve students and what would happen if our request is not funded. I'd like to ask Lori Voss, Vice President of Administration at Minnesota West Community and Technical College, and Jan Mahoney, Vice President for Finance and Administration at Minnesota University Moorhead, to join me. By way of introduction, if I might, Lori Voss is the Vice President of Finance and Administration and CFO at Minnesota West. She is responsible for finance, budget, human resource, facilities, and is presently serving as the Interim Foundation Director. Jan Mahoney is Vice President and CFO at the Minnesota State University Moorhead. a position she has held since 2010. Jan's responsibilities include finance, budget, facilities, public safety, and athletics. Prior to that, she served 6 years as VP and CFO at St. Paul College. Before that, she served 17 years as CFO at Alexandria Technical College with a stretch as interim president. So if I might, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn to my colleagues.
Okay. Who's going to begin, and would you please identify yourself, please?
I'll be starting. My name is Lori Voss, and I'm from Minnesota West Community and Technical College. Chair Nornes, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of the students, faculty, staff, and leadership of Minnesota West Community and Technical College. Minnesota West serves an area of rural Minnesota that includes 21,000 square miles. We have campuses in Canby, Granite Falls, Jackson, Pipestone, and Worthington, along with centers in Laverne, Marshall, and Redwood Falls. A circle tour would rack up over 300 miles on your vehicle. Minnesota West has a history of responding to budget challenges. Our campuses have been pioneers in shared services. We have centralized financial aid, human resources, and business office functions. We instituted a one-stop model that provides students access to services through campus personnel and also to services to personnel across campuses and at a call center. Recently, we changed how we deliver bookstore services by combining responsibilities for all campuses at three locations. We've made tough choices, including closing programs, but we've tried to respond to budget challenges with creative solutions. For example, we eliminated duplication of programming across our college in all but two. We sold two buildings totaling over 20,000 square feet on our Canby campus. We entered into lease arrangements for 17,000 square feet for nearly $150,000 annually. Our tenants include the National Park Service, Southwest West Central Service Cooperative, Southwest Mental Health, the Minnesota System Office, and Pipestone Area Schools. This past summer, we closed our center at Fairmont. We also have a very lean administrative structure with a single dean or vice president overseeing multiple areas that might have been reported to two deans or two vice presidents at our college 10 years ago, all while continuing to provide that oversight and direction at five campuses and three centers. We're responding to the needs of the workforce in our community, but that's getting harder and harder to do. We're currently investing in new programming, but only through the support of our industry partners. In response to the need for trained welders, we have gathered up funding to renovate and equip a welding lab at our Jackson campus. By combining funds remaining after the completion of some HEPA projects with industry support to the matched leveraged equipment funds, the leveraged equipment funds themselves, and institutional funds. Together, we will be able to complete the welding lab by this fall and provide 22 additional trained welders into the workforce, as well as upskill the incumbent workforce in welding areas. Additionally, we're working with our K-12 partners. We search every day for new models of service delivery for secondary tech ed. This spring, the Pipestone Area Schools began a carpentry class in our carpentry lab. They moved their welding course to our HVAC lab. The welding equipment supplied by the school district can be accessed by our customized training department. We are in our second semester of welding and nurse aid training delivered at Maytech, which is Marshall Area Technical School, through a partnership with Marshall Public Schools. Minnesota West has experienced 3 years of operating losses. Fiscal year 15 will end in a loss as well. Our enrollment has declined from a high in fiscal year 11, while our headcount has remained relatively steady. And our students look different. They come to us with different attributes. They're older, they're more diverse, and they have more commitments outside of their education. Unemployment is low in the state and even lower in Southwest Minnesota. We are called on now more than ever to work with employers and the incumbent workforce. The $142 million request presented by the Board of Trustees is critical to Minnesota West, just as it is to other rural colleges across the state. It's critical to the success of our students and to business and industry that will employ them. It will make a difference in the communities we serve. This budget request is not made to support wants, but rather needs. It's to support operating expenses. Without your support, there will be significant consequences. To be perfectly honest, I'm not sure where to look for further cuts in our budget. Without your support, the college will likely have further program closures and reduced course section offerings. Students will notice a marked reduction in services and access. Our aging buildings will suffer from reduced investment, and we'll be unable to respond to the needs of our business and industry partnerships. And lastly, our communities will be affected by the reduction in workforce. There are risks to this kind of response. The college cannot risk a spiral of continued reductions in program and course section offerings, as it's a direct correlation to future enrollment. Risks increase when services to students are reduced. Risks that relate to successful program completion. Risk increases when positions are collapsed. The college's ability to be in front of legal and compliance issues will be compromised. I'm confident that with your support of the Board of Trustees' request, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities will continue to do the good work that we do. And at Minnesota West, we will protect the quality of our programs and continue to provide access to students in rural Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. And next, Jan Mahoney.
Yes. For the record, I am Jan Mahoney, Vice President at Minnesota State University, Moorhead. Chair Nornes, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to share the challenges and opportunities at our university. MSU Moorhead serves over 8,000 students. The university's largest programs put teachers in our Minnesota schools, accountants in our CPA firms, financiers in our banks, and nurses in our healthcare facilities. Located in the Red River Valley, we border a state that is making substantial investments in higher education due to a booming North Dakota economy. We view North Dakota's investment as a threat to enrollment because they have the potential to draw students from both sides of the border and away from MSU Moorhead. The growing economy in our region is creating high demand for skilled employees in manufacturing, business, healthcare, and science industries. We have listened to our business and industry partners. This academic year, we have added master's programs that focus on business, accounting, finance, and healthcare. We've also added certificates and degrees in banking, project management, analytics, entrepreneurship, and we have expanded our online programs. Adding these programs has not come without pain. Due to declining enrollments and the necessity to remain sustainable, the university was forced to drastically reduce expenses. In September of 2013, we sought input from our campus community to create a process, criteria, and timeline for budget reduction decisions. The result? Our budgets in fiscal years 2015 and 2016 have been reduced by $6.5 million. The reduction was devastating. There are now 46 fewer FTE faculty and staff and 5 fewer programs at MSUM. The pain? The pain came when students were told their program would be closed, a program these students were passionate about. The pain came when we had to tell faculty and staff that their positions were being eliminated. The pain came when we had to tell programs and departments that they had to continue to deliver instruction, programs, and services of even greater quality, but with fewer faculty, staff, and administrators. At MSUM, we're all feeling this pain. Now, more than ever, we need your help. We want to continue to do what we do best. transform the world by transforming lives. But we can't do it without financial support from our state. Transforming lives at MSUM is guided by our strategic anchors. We have three of them. They are focusing relentlessly on student achievement and students' return on their investment, embedding and supporting diversity in every facet of the university, and ensuring that MSUM is indispensable to the social, cultural, and economic advancement of Moorhead and the surrounding region. We want nothing more than to continue putting teachers in our schools, accountants in our CPA firms, financiers in our banks, and nurses in our healthcare facilities. We hope that you will invest in MSUM, in MinSCU, and in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And if I might thank you to both of our colleagues who joined us today to illustrate what incredible passion and energy is present all across our system amongst all of our colleges and universities working to ensure quality and access across the system. So, Chair Nornes and committee, if I might summarize, our request of $142 million will allow our colleges and universities to support our faculty and staff, avoid layoffs, avoid tuition increases, and continue playing their absolutely critical role in meeting the challenges facing Minnesota. Again, funding will protect programs, protect our ability to deliver those programs, and protect affordability. Our board takes very seriously its charge to provide governance oversight to our 31 colleges and universities. Trustee Vekic and his fellow board members are very aware of the financial condition of our colleges and universities, and they have asked me to convey to you their commitment to the charge in state statute to govern and operate the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. It is the board's commitment that if the legislative request is fully funded, the board will hold tuition resident rates at current levels. Thank you.
Chair Nornes, members of the committee.
Councilor Rosenstone.
As you recall from our overview presentation at St. Paul College last month, each year we produce more than 40,000 graduates. Graduates become the workforce of Minnesota. We graduate 9 out of 10 of the state's mechanics, 9 out of 10 of those working in manufacturing, 8 out of 10 of those in law enforcement, 7 out of 10 in the trades, 7 out of 10 employed in agriculture, 3 out of 4 of the nurses, 1/2 of all the teachers, 1/2 of all the business graduates, 1/2 of those in information technology, and the list goes on and on and on. That's possible because we have the right programs, right faculty, and the right staff who are dedicated to producing the quality graduates that communities across our state desperately need. It's also possible because of the kind of partnerships that Trustee Vekic introduced you to, partnerships like the Great Go Partnership, working with our colleges to ensure that our students are trained on 21st century equipment prepared for the workforce of the future. Partnerships like this are happening all over the state and in communities across Minnesota because it is a core commitment of our system of colleges and universities that we are the partner of choice to meet Minnesota's community and workforce needs. But in order for us to continue addressing the workforce challenges that Minnesota faces today and will face even in greater terms in the years ahead, we have to find a way to work together to solve the two puzzles that I mentioned earlier. First, how do we protect the programs that are essential to serving our students and serving regions across Minnesota, programs that allow students to be prepared to serve the communities and ensure a vibrant workforce, programs that are essential not just for their personal prosperity, but the prosperity of businesses and communities across the state and essential to the prosperity of all of Minnesota. And second, how do we work together to protect affordability? The decisions that you make that we make this session will have a direct impact on our ability to produce the workforce that Minnesota needs, not just in the next 5 years, but in the decades to come. It's up to all of us to meet the challenges that Minnesota faces. It's how we will all be remembered. And if we make the right decisions, we will be taking the steps necessary to ensure prosperity to communities across Minnesota and every region of Minnesota. Prosperity for all. With that, Chair Nornes, we stand ready to respond to any questions you and members of the committee might have. Thank you.
Chancellor Rosenstiel, we have a couple of questions. I believe one of the questioners left the room temporarily, but I'll expect them back. Before we do that, I was just going to just point out this one. This is very helpful, highlighting all of the colleges around. And I pointed to, or found one here, actually, that I recognize. This is sort of like subtle advertising, I think, because you've actually featured my neighbor in this booklet.
Pure accident, Chair Nornes, I assure you.
Was it? Very talented, and she speaks highly of the college, says that I was challenged in classes as well as in music and theater, and I was supported by my professors. The instructors at M-State are truly interested in the well-being of their students. She has auditioned in front of some of the most important people in New York City. She's very talented, and the college was also lucky to have her as a student, but she really speaks highly of that particular institution. So this is very helpful, I think, as everyone else in the committee can probably find a college near them and similar comments. So, but Katie, we just call her Katie. Representative Grunhagen, you have a question.
I only got one question.
Just one?
No, I just got a couple.
We have time.
Okay, we got time. Okay, thank you, Ms. Chair. Somebody suggested that we go around, everybody ask one question, then go back. But, I mean, just food for thought.
It wasn't me.
It wasn't you, yeah. That's probably the main one. So, just on page 13 under the compensation, is that 3% compensation? Does that include benefits, steps, and lanes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, what you see on page 13 is a planning estimate of 3% a year, including everything. Fringe benefits, changes in health insurance costs to the employer, any step increases, wage base across the board, wage increases. If an employee is promoted, that cost is not provided for here. The department is expected to manage that cost inside their existing budget.
Representative Grunhagen?
Yeah, that. So basically the contracts are not settled. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, we are currently in a period of settled contracts. This budget is for the period starting July 1, and we do not have contracts in place for the period starting July 1.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and that just, you know, I've expressed this before, having negotiated contracts in public schools, chief negotiator. It just, you know, I could just see in a couple of years you're going to come back and you're going to be short several million because you settled contracts over what we gave you for the increase. And, you know, I call me pessimistic after watching how this works at the public school level for 16 years. It, you know, it just, I wish there were some type of safeguard we could put in place that we actually settled the contracts at those amounts. But anyway, so I do have some reservations there, but I'll leave it at that for right now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Nornes, might I?
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Very important question, very important discussion, and two thoughts to try to contribute to it. First, many of our contracts, we do not have control over how to settle them. Mm-hmm. They're negotiated by MMB, and we live by the settlement that MMB reaches. But the contracts that the board does have control over, the board in the last round of negotiation made it crystal clear to our negotiating team, do not spend what we do not have. And we did not spend what we did not have and settled in the constraints of the resources that were available to settle those contracts. So the board has been pretty clear with us
And we're not going to settle contracts and then come back and say, but we settled for more than we had as resources. We stay within the constraints of the resources we have.
Mr. Chair? Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you for that response, Chancellor Rosenquist. But the but you acknowledge, there's settlements you don't have control over. And in talking to my community college in my area, that's where the problem comes in, where there's settlements open above what they have as far as funds available, and the result is it puts increasing pressure on the budgets to make reductions and over and above what your funding is.
Chair Nornes,
Representative
Grughagen, we're very much aware of that, and I think you, as a committee, should be holding us responsible for the things that are within our control and help us for the things that are not within our control.
Chancellor, maybe you can refresh, or maybe Ms. King, kind of the schedule of those other contracts. It's kind of out of sync with the legislature, I believe.
Mr. Chair, can you fill us in on timetable? Certainly, Mr. Chair, that they all run on a July 1, June 30 year, and they're all up for new negotiations as of this July 1. So MMB has started discussions at the staff level to open the negotiations for AFSCME and MAPE and middle management, and they'll do that work this spring so that contracts can be effective July 1 of 15, and then they run 24 months from there. So we are, I think we are in sync, because we're doing budget planning right now for the next fiscal year, and we're here talking to you about what we'd like to provide in the budget as an assumption about compensation increases. And we likewise will start our work with our faculty unions in negotiations this spring for their contracts that also begin July 1 of this summer. So they all are on the same 24-month cycle, and it's all starting right now.
Okay. Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question directly to this point. And so when you were talking about the two revenue sources, that slide, and I just want to make sure that the whole committee really understands what we're talking about, because if I'm understanding this correctly, this is quite substantial to your budget. And that is, I believe you said that 93% of your staff and faculty, of your payroll, salaries and payroll, are union statewide negotiated salaries. Is that not quite?
If you'd give me the page number, I'll walk through that with you. What this shows us is that on the right-hand side, starting from the bottom, the blue bar and the red bar are our faculty groups, MSCF and IFO. The third faculty group is up a couple of spots there in the purple. Those three contracts are negotiated by our negotiators. Everything else on this chart is negotiated by MMB. And what I said was that 93% of our employees in total are unionized. Of that 93%, 59% of them are faculty, and we negotiate those contracts. And the remainder are in the classified units, and those are negotiated by Minnesota Management and Budget. Okay. Does that help?
Yeah,
that
does.
O'Neill?
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, that was different than what I understood what you were saying before, so I appreciate the distinction between the two, because I don't think, unless I stepped out and you had said it then, but I don't think you had said that in your testimony before. And that's really important for us to understand, is how much of this you actually have control over, like you alluded to. So you said 59% of the 93%, I guess.
That's correct, 59% of 100%. 60% of our employees are faculty, and we negotiate faculty contracts.
Thank you.
You bet.
Representative Whelan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who best to direct this question to, but I met with a couple of students and constituents that go to Anoka Tech and Anoka Ramsey recently, and they provided me with some interesting information showing that Minnesota two-year public institutions are the third highest tuition and fees in the nation. And I'm just wondering if we have information, or if you have information, on why that might be in comparison with other states.
Certainly, Mr. Chair and Representative Whelan, good afternoon. That is absolutely accurate. When you compare tuition and fees at the two-year schools to other two-year schools around the country, that is the right conclusion. That has been the conclusion for over 20 years. Starting in Minnesota back in the mid-70s, policy decisions at this table were made about what expectations there were for tuition versus state support. And when the merger happened in 1995, that situation existed. We had very high tuition expectations compared to national other national two-year colleges. And that situation persists to this day. That's in large part why our request asks you to help us move back toward a 50-50 arrangement between state support and tuition, to help us remove a little bit of that circumstance from students. But it goes back 30 years. It goes back to decisions that were made when higher education funding in Minnesota was being designed back in the 80s.
Sure, notice that I might add.
Chancellor.
Thank you. One other thing I think that we need to keep into account is not the sticker price, but the net cost. And Minnesota is also blessed with one of the most luxurious, well-funded state grant programs in the nation. And so if we're going to make comparisons, we need to get the whole picture of things we need to compare to understand what the burden is on our students compared to other states. And so we can do the math and help behind the scenes and get back if you want on when you take into account the generous state grants that exist in Minnesota compared to other states, where does it all sort out? But I think the most important point, as Vice Chancellor King was suggesting, our goal is to hold the line on the cost to our students, and that's why you have the proposal from us that you do.
Representative Whelan.
Thank you for that. That's definitely helpful, and I think that information would be wonderful to have. Just as a quick follow-up, so kind of what I would understand here is that other states then provide a greater allocation and or more funding to their higher ed public systems for the two-year schools. And is that understanding correct, or maybe not?
Chair, Representative Whelan, just maybe as an anecdote to your question, I recall several years ago when California was having a big battle over their higher education funding. What they were battling over was raising tuition from $25 a credit to $50 a credit. And our tuition has been over $100 a credit for over 10 years. It is very local how higher education is financed from one place to the next. Some states have a local property tax. Other states don't charge tuition at all in certain sectors. So it's very, very variable. But if I might take us back to this graph that was in your materials, because notwithstanding how all of this compares from one state to the next, we live in Minnesota, and the impact is on our Minnesota people. And so I think this chart really helps illustrate that when you look at a household and what the household income is, and you measure what we're asking that household to pay in tuition at a state college, it represents about 5.8% of household income. And this number has been flat for 10 years. If we want it to be 1%, we can do that math for you. That would be a substantial increase in state investment. Or if we want to limit access so that we can lower the price, that would be another approach. But we live where we are today, and we've worked very hard to do no harm to the price for students over these last 10 years.
Representative Whelan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you for that. That definitely helps my understanding a little bit, and I'll look forward to getting more information from you on the grant, our grant program, and how that might affect our ranking, and also hopefully some comparative data as far as how much these other states you know, if it's all if locally funded or how much the state provides and all these different funding mechanisms for higher ed, that would be helpful.
Chair Nordis, if I might, one other table we should share with you and share with members of the committee is a table that we shared with the House Ways and Means Committee yesterday. A decade ago, per student being served in the state of Minnesota, this is not MinSCU, this is all of higher education, all dollars fully loaded, state grant, investment institution alike, a decade ago, Minnesota was spending roughly 20% more than the average state in America. We have fallen faster than almost any state in the nation, and we're now spending about 20% less than the average state in the nation. That's a consequence of lots of decisions made over lots of years by lots of legislatures, but that's been the consequence for the investment we've made in the state that has a greater need for an educated workforce than any other state in the nation. That's the puzzle we need to solve together.
Thank you. The next question comes from Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Whalen, I've long been concerned with this long history we have of being a high tuition, high scholarship grant state. I personally don't like it, but we have that as our legacy. We deal with it every year here at this table. So thank you for your presentation, and you've had your challenges over the years. I appreciate your budget. And I appreciate the challenges. Leslie McClellan from Rochester Community Technical College is here, and WSU's President Scott Olson is here. And, you know, those are the folks that I see day to day, and I know the struggles that they've gone through, the cuts they've had to make, and the repercussions that they personally have felt because of some of those cuts that they've made. And it's not been very pretty every moment. And you also know that I have interest in making some changes at the U and at MinSCU. And I talked to you this morning, Chancellor, about some of the changes I am proposing, and that bill will be filed on Monday, and I hope all of you will consider signing on to that particular proposal that'll deal with some issues. My question is, I'm going to be asking to spend a little bit of money, though maybe it'll come on over the years, and How will you manage perhaps some policy decisions that might come from this body and incorporate those into your budget request that you have before you? That's my first question. And then the second one I'd like you to address, and be gentle with me. tell me you'll find a way to do it. And then the second one has to do with, if you could just address this, I'm looking through this great book with all the colleges described. I'm pretty surprised, not wholly, but pretty surprised at the number of part-time students, which eclipses full-time students in many, many of your colleges throughout this book. The universities, not quite so much, but even one of those, I think, has more part-time than full-time. But the Northeast Higher Ed District seems to be doing something very different, and you know one of my interests is getting kids to take more full-time school rather than spending forever and a day taking part-time classes, and I wonder if you could explain to me what the Northeast Higher Ed District is doing. There's smaller classes, and that may be part of it. It may be more personal, but they seem to have significantly more full-time students overall than many of the other programs in the book, and maybe you don't know, and it's something that someone could get me in the future. That'd be fine.
Chancellor Rosenstahl.
Chair Nornes, Representative Norton, first, thank you for this morning's conversation. I appreciate very much the work you're doing. Let me try to take the second question first, which is to explain the range, which is not something I think any of us could take on, but in all seriousness, a number of the colleges up on the range have residences across the great distances that exist in that part of our state. And so when you have students that are living in a residential situation at our community colleges, it's a very different situation than if you have students that are also engaged in full-time work and all the things associated with families and other commitments. And so we do have in greater Minnesota several of our colleges that now have residences. Alexandria Tech brought on a residence, I think, about 3 years ago with help from their foundation. That's, I think, going to contribute to the differences, but we could try to get a little more detail for you. With respect to your first question, it's still, I think, very abstract to know exactly what the
policy changes are that the legislature might be acting upon and how they would impact the budget. I think two things to emphasize there. First and foremost, assuming we are not dramatically cutting programs and campuses, we have a $142 million problem that we all solve together going into the next biennium. And so anything that's done that reduces funds that are available to solve that $142 million problem, because we're going to do something else with those dollars, still leaves us a $142 million problem, assuming we're going to have a very modest compensation increase and protect students on tuition. So it's a little hard, quite frankly, to be more specific until we know what the specifics are that you or your colleagues would have in mind. But I would say that the commitment that I have made to our board, to our students, to our faculty bargaining units, and to our presidents, that if we need to make some adjustments as a result of where the legislature decides to go, we're going to sit down together the way we did when we crafted this proposal and figure out what the best path to move forward is that we'd recommend to the board for their consideration.
Representative Norton.
And Mr. Chair, just to follow up, and this is directed to you, and I served under you one other time, and you had the horrible task of having a horrible budget target and having to make significant cuts. And so I'm just going to speak for myself here, saying, you know, we haven't allowed for innovation for several years at our colleges, and it's time that some innovation occurs and some changes occur. And I think there's a plan to do it, and I plan on adding to that plan. Sorry, but I'm going to add a little bit maybe to that. But we have to fund our universities and our college system in an appropriate way. So I'm just going to urge you very much to ask for a high budget target and get some of this surplus for this committee, because that didn't happen to you last time. And so I'm hoping for you and for this whole body to have a better outcome at the end. And also, just to follow up on the range, which I can never understand, but I would be interested to see with the high full-time attendance that they have, and there are different programs. I think there's five programs here, to know if the graduation rate is also higher. So if you could get me that information at some point, I'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. I intend to wear a white hat as we go through this process. Representative Bernardi, you're back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know what we all talked about while I was out with constituents, but I'll just make one comment, and maybe you can comment back about it as well. But you talked about your computer system and your technology. I have children that are going to Minsky schools right now, one in graduate school and one in technical school and regular college. I mean, so I'm glad I actually explained that, because what I'm finding is students are going to multiple Minsky colleges to get a degree. I don't think that the systems are very computer friendly to the students. And I think, I'm just thinking a lot of it has to do with local control of the colleges and universities. And one thing I heard you talk about is cost control and increase efficiency. I would love to see, in that same sentence, improve the student experience and being able to go to multiple sites to be able to get information. It's not very easy. And these students are busy. They're working. They're going to school. They need to have it as a streamlined, user-friendly system.
Ms. Kane, or Chancellor, whoever.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, we completely agree with you. We completely agree with you, and we have worked tirelessly with very limited resources to bend our technology platform toward students. with your help, some 7 or 8 years ago now, received extra money to work on the technology system. Otherwise, we funded it all internally. And we're talking about one of the largest systems in the country because of our size. We have a very large discussion going on right now about a long-term plan for the technology program and services, and its organizing feature is to make it much, much, much more friendly for students and friendly for faculty who are also teaching in several places, or teaching online and in the classroom. We're a long way from offering the best technical experience that money can buy, but it's part of our strategic planning process. We find that something in the order of 40% of our students are dual enrolled, We'll get that number for you, but you're absolutely right. Students are registering at multiple places or registering online and in the classroom, and that puts a whole different technical framework on the system that we're working hard on.
Representative Bernardi, is that Chancellor, do you have a comment?
If I might, Representative Bernardi, I concur, you are exactly on the mark. The 46% of all of our graduates with baccalaureate degrees have attended more than one institution. Over a third of those who get an associate's degree have attended more than one institution. Mm-hmm. And as you suggested, many of our students are now attending multiple institutions in the same semester.
Mm-hmm.
We were not built for that, but our students are now built for that, and we need to adjust. Mm-hmm. With help from the IT team at Winona State University, we, in the last, I think it was 18 months, got to the situation where you have one ID and one login that'll work on any computer anywhere in the state of Minnesota in the MinSCU system. That's an incredible innovation and an important one. But it's just the first step of having a technology platform that's allowing, would allow students to enjoy the full riches of the learning opportunities on each of our campuses. So as one student suggested to me, imagine a world that if you're sitting at St. Paul College and you're trying to register for class and the class is already filled, what would pop up immediately on your screen is the availability of that class at MCTC or at Century College or North Hennepin or at Normandale. That would allow us to have systems that would serve students in the ways they want to use the resources of our system that are not there right now. As Vice Chancellor King suggested, that's heart and soul of the planning process that's underway right now to ensure that we have systems in place that are meeting the needs of the students of today. And as she suggests, we'll be back in 2 years to talk to you about what that's going to cost.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair and our testifiers, I would like to be a part of that because we talk about graduation rates and hold you accountable for that. Part of it is being able to have a computer system that helps support that and helps mm-hmm. students be able to navigate and get through as quick as possible.
Sure.
Exactly right.
Representative Winkler, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if I could just ask a question of Ms. Mahoney from Moorhead. Thank you. I'm just curious, on a specific and practical example of what you did with the $6.5 million budget cut. You reduced FTEs and you said you eliminated five programs, but you also mentioned expanding other programs or working with industry partners. Could you just give more detail about what you closed down, what kind of FTEs you eliminated, and what kind of programs you expanded?
Ms. Mahoney.
Certainly, Representative and Chair Nordis. We closed down the programs Community Health, American Cultural Studies, Multicultural Studies, I'm sorry, Music Composition, the Master in Fine Arts, and Medical Lab Technology. We also merged many programs. I don't have that list readily available. The cut was 44 faculty and 2 staff positions, and those positions were eliminated mainly through early retirements. At the end of the day, we had 2 layoffs.
Mr. Winkler.
And Ms. Mahoney, and then you mentioned something towards about expanding programs, a business program maybe, or expanding partnerships with local businesses. So I wonder if you could touch on what you did on the other side.
Absolutely.
Mahoney?
We at the university, we call them sector breakfasts, where we invite our business and industry partners into our university, like finance partners, 1 month. It might be healthcare partners another month, and we listen to what they need. And as a result of listening to what they need, we added an MBA, an MBA in healthcare management, a master's in healthcare administration, a master's in finance and accounting, a BA in project management, a certificate in banking and finance, a certificate in business analytics, a certificate in entrepreneurship, and an online business degree completer program, and then at the same time doubled our enrollment in our online RN to BSN program.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Ms. Mahoney. That was very helpful information. This just calls, and this question now is to the Chancellor. This raises for me the question of what service MNSCU is providing and how we navigate a couple of tensions. Obviously, Ms. Mahoney talked about the students who were not happy with the programs that were eliminated, and it was pretty clear that it was a reduction of liberal arts, traditional liberal arts type programs, and a greater concentration or expansion of finance, business, healthcare management, MBA, and so forth, based on industry needs. Does MNSCU follow what students want to study, or does and do they get guidance in that, or does MNSCU primarily provide the courses that the students need to have, in MNSCU's opinion? What's the governing philosophy there?
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Nornes, Trustee, or rather, Representative Winkler, excellent question, and there is no, quote, the MNSCU answer to that question. These are questions which, through the consultative processes of our colleges and universities, are worked out college by college, university by university. We can decide in the abstract what we think the courses are that students ought to take. And if no one shows up, we have a huge financial problem that we need to solve. We can listen to business and industry, and if they get it wrong, we still have a huge financial problem to solve. It's a combination, I think, of the judgment of our faculty of what's needed to prepare people for great careers and great lives, and the reality of you can have great programs providing great preparation, thinking about meeting a need, but if there are no students in those programs, they are not sustainable, given, as we saw, that over half the budget's coming from tuition, not state support. So if we happen to live in a world where two-thirds of the support was going to be there for the program, regardless of whether the seats were filled, it would provide a very different decision mechanism, I suspect, in many of the decisions being made on the campus, than a world where over half of the funds have to be provided by people in the classrooms. If we would have had that answer given by a chief financial officer of one of our technical colleges, you would see there are many technical programs that are at risk too because of our inability to find students to fill those courses or inability to sustain them given how much of the sustainability of those courses and programs depend upon the tuition revenue, where if it's not there, there's no way to balance the books. So it's a combination of both, I would argue, but again, it's decisions that are made campus by campus, not decisions that MNSCU makes for our campuses.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor, I guess the question then becomes, how good is the guidance that students receive in selecting their coursework? And how much of your resources are dedicated to helping students make good decisions? I say in a somewhat flip way that if students were senior citizens, there would be much more tight regulation of what students are allowed to spend their money on with the high-stakes financial decisions that they're making. They're making lifetime financial decisions in some ways because of the cost and the debt involved. And many of those decisions may or may not be well informed by future workforce requirements. Yeah. So in this consultative process, I think you called it, what part of that is educating students about what the jobs are and what their realistic return is on the investment that they're making in their education?
Chair Nornes, Representative Winkler, terrific question, fundamental question to ensuring that the investments we're making, that you're making, our students are making, are aligning with what they need in order to live the lives they imagine living. Several parts of the puzzle that we've been working on. The world's greatest workforce legislation that this legislature passed 2 years ago was about doing a better job of aligning higher education and high schools. And part of that legislation spoke about the need for every single student to have a plan for post-secondary education, a plan for career. Part of that plan requires better information about where the hot careers are going to be in the future and what kind of skills are the ones that are likely to give you the best return, if you will, given what careers are going to grow and what jobs are going to look like down the road. We're working collaboratively with Commissioner Kasilius on the implementation of that plan, and that's part of getting this puzzle solved that you've put on the table for us. The second part of the puzzle is making sure we have a better idea, a deeper understanding, as well as a better idea of where the puck's going to be in 3 or 4 years. So right now, unfortunately, we've all been relying on data that's depending on the date between 6 months and 9 months old. It's the data that DEED gets from the U.S. Department of Labor statistics. So let's imagine that we use that data, and instantaneously DEED puts it out to us, and instantaneously our faculty create the programs aligning with that data, and we admit the first student. And we have a program exactly aligned with what the data said the needs are. At our colleges, it's 18 months before the student graduates. At our university, it's closer to 4 years before the student graduates. And now, because of the structural lag and because the data we're using is old, we're skating to where the puck was 24, 48 months ago. That simply isn't good enough. So we've been investing in partnership with DEED, in partnership with the Itasca Project, in consultation with some 90 businesses across the state, with high school counselors, and with our colleges and universities, is looking at some new tools which are more real-time and more granular about the specific needs that are needed to be prepared for the hot careers and hot jobs of the future. That is tested. We did pilot studies across the state. It's now being brought to scale statewide through our partnership with DEED, our partnership with MDE, our partnership with the workforce centers, and with businesses across the state. That data is going to be able to inform better the decisions that our students are making, the decisions our faculty are making about the curriculum, the decisions that deans are making about where we need to grow programs and try to do it in a way aligned with what the workforce needs in Minnesota. But your question hits to the very heart of making sure that the investments our students are making and the investments the good people of Minnesota are making are indeed aligning with what the workforce needs of the state are going forward. And those are the steps we've been taking to try to do a better job on that.
Last question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler.
But I'm going to put two of them together.
That's fine.
The question is, do MNSCU students, stop, I'm going to back up. Do you have enough counselors in your institutions to help students, and will that be a priority as you look at charting the future in future years? Real people actually talking to students about their interests, dreams, hopes, goals, suitability, and all of those things.
Chancellor?
Chair Nornes, Representative Winkler, I've only seen through the gallery walks last fall the preliminary ideas that have come out of the Charting the Future Committee focusing on student success. One of the four ideas that they brought forward is substantial greater investment in advising, both with respect to planning for careers as well as the kind of intrusive advising that Representative Norton and I discussed this morning. They see that as key to the success of students, both at our colleges and universities, success being defined here not only as making it to the finish line, but making it a finish line in a way that's going to lead to the next step you want to take as a result of that degree. The final recommendations, the final strategies coming out of that team will be available, I think, by June. But I anticipate, given the preliminary work they shared with us in the gallery walks last fall, that advising is going to be an area that I think we really need to double down and do a better job.
Thank you.
Next, we have Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, Chancellor, Vice Chancellor, if you could provide some comment on what your enrollment projections were the last two academic years, how that compared to the actual enrollment numbers, and then what you anticipate for enrollment projections to be, you know, at least for the next academic year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, certainly. Give me just a second to get to the right piece of paper. Our enrollment projection for the year we're in now is about 138,000 FYE, and that represents about a 3.5% decline from fiscal 14. Our projection for the year next year, the fiscal 16, as I recall, is about flat to fiscal 15. So we've had pretty substantial enrollment declines the last several years, but our campuses have been working really hard launching enrollment strategies, retention strategies, persistence strategies, and they're cautiously optimistic that we've hit the bottom from an enrollment standpoint, and that they now have strategies underway to run along the bottom and start to come back up. We're still about 7% above where we were in 2005, but we have had a very volatile experience, especially at the technical colleges, and that's tied directly to what goes on in the labor market. I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to get you more exact answers to those questions if you'd like. We certainly have them.
Chancellor.
Representative Nornes, Representative Lean, the one of the biggest variables in our enrollments is the unemployment rate in Minnesota. And so we run countercyclical. When we're in a recession, as we were in the mother of all recessions, starting in 2008, our enrollment soared. It soared because it was time that students and incumbent workers said this is the time to be investing in building new career, building new skills necessary to prepare for the work that needs to be done when we come out of the recession. And when the recession is over and unemployment tumbles, people are at work because they can get great jobs at great salaries. And they leave our colleges, in particular, a little less leave our universities. So part of the puzzle for us in getting this exactly right is getting a handle on exactly what that unemployment rate is going to be a year from now. And as we all know, the good news was unemployment fell a whole lot faster in Minnesota than any of us expected. That's great news. It's a challenge that our colleges and universities have to deal with. And so part of the modeling we do, and we have our director of institutional research working with all of our colleges and universities on modeling this, there are some variables we can do a pretty good job of predicting, like the number of high school graduates, the number of people aged 18 to 34. That moves pretty slowly year to year. We can get a pretty good handle on that. But the economic variables that also drive enrollments for us, and we're much more tied to the economic cycle than the University of Minnesota or than many of our private colleges in the state are, that's harder for us to get our hands on it, just as it's harder for economists to get it exactly right. And that's where we're going to be off of it.
Representative Lean, follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would be good to get that information going back, you know, at least a couple academic years, along with the projections that the system had put out. I think, too, it's important for us to be thinking about, you know, enrollment projections for campuses in Seven County Metro versus Greater Minnesota and how that relates to different unemployment rates. I did also want to ask a couple on a couple other points, and I'll maybe just try to roll them into one as I see we're getting short on time. But the first would be information about the $44 million in internal savings that were realized over the last biennium. A little more information, if you can comment a little bit about that, and maybe if you could provide some detailed information to the committee members. But also if you could comment on the progress undergoing between the system and the faculty conversations in relation to the budget projection the governor didn't lay out for Minsky, as in anticipation of some of those relationships improving.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Representative Lean, you were provided to the committee this would have been maybe a month ago, a report that detailed all the reallocations that our colleges and universities have done as part of their fiscal 14 work, and we'll make sure that you get it. What it illustrates is that in fiscal 14, we reallocated $29 million. $18 million of that was an absolute budget reduction, and $11 million of it was a reassignment of budget dollars from one use to another. I think what you heard in the Moorhead story There was probably a substantial reallocation there. Part of the reallocation went from low enrollment programs to new programs, and part of it went to the budget reduction. And that's going on all over our campuses. $29 million was reported in fiscal 14. We expect a similar number in fiscal 15 and 16 and 17. Over the last 5 years or so, our campuses have reallocated over $100 million. It's just a normal course of business from 1 year to the next. But you did get a full report on this by school, and I will go back upstream and find out why it's news to you and make sure that you get a copy of it.
Representative Lee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think for the new committee members, new to the committee, that would be beneficial.
Certainly,
too.
Absolutely. We'll circle back and make sure everyone has it.
I will take a stab at your second question, equally important. A question. There have been meetings that have gone on regularly for the last several months. I am optimistic that there will be progress made that will satisfy the governor's concern. We've agreed not to say more than that at this time, and I want to respect the confidentiality of those discussions. But I assure you there's been ongoing discussions, and they've been very productive.
Okay. Thank you. Moving on, Representative O'Neill, you're next.
Thank you, Chair. So while we were talking, I sat and went through this whole thing and added it all up since we didn't really have, I'm a spreadsheet kind of person like Representative Barrett, so I'm sitting here and adding everything up, and maybe I did an error, but it was like $5 million to what you have as your ask when I went through and added up every university and college and everything, and I may have just made an error, but I'm still struggling to understand, you know, because, you know, I'm looking at all your charts and graphs, and some of it is you know, total appropriations, but to really understand your ask, you know, I'm a spreadsheet person, and so I was trying to come up with it. But if you could help me just understand, of the $142 million that you're asking for, how much of that is specifically negotiated by the governor and the MMB, by the executive branch with MMB? Is that the same percentage? Because I realize about 75% or so are salaries of your expenditures, and of that, 41% are negotiated by the executive branch. So of the 142, how much is attributed to what you think is going to be negotated? I guess that's the first question, and I have a follow-up.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, and Trustee O'Neill, if you look at the slide 13, let me just break it down into parts here for you. Slide 13 shows you the arithmetic behind our request. And it represents a 3% compensation increase in 16 and another 3% in 17. So you take that $108 million and divide it by 3 because you have the biennial math issue here. So let's say that's $35 million in the first year. That $35 million moves forward then into the second year. And then there's a new $35 or $40 million that goes on top. So that's the first thing to be thinking about, is that this 108 is really three increases. The math was done at 3%. We did not do the math on a per union level, nor have we had conversations with the Department of Management and Budget about how they're approaching classified contracts. What we will say to them is we're budgeting for a 3% with your help, and so that means 3% across all of these units. Just because of PELRA, we go into negotiations with a sort of a wider lens on the arithmetic, but the overall planning number is 3% in total across all the units.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I understand that part, but I guess what I'm trying to get at is it the 41% of 108 that MMB is negotiating? We're just trying to understand. You had asked us not to hold you responsible for what you cannot be responsible for, and so I'm just trying to get to what that number would be.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, let me do a little math for you. It's not linear, and I apologize for that. So we'll have to come back to you with an answer.
Right, and that's what I was...
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. That's what I was struggling with, because there's a lot of numbers floating around, and you've got your total appropriations, you've got your increased ask, you've got the different percentages that MMB are responsible for. It's that's 41% of the staff, but I don't know what their salaries are, so we're asking for transparency. And if you could just clearly tell us what part are you not responsible to negotiate, that would be incredibly helpful, I think, to the committee. Second part of my question. If we're not able to provide a full appropriation that you're asking, the whole 142, what then will be your priorities, and will a tuition freeze continue to be your priority?
Chancellor, are you?
Chair Nornes, Representative O'Neill, our priority is $142 million. And that $142 million will allow us to do two things which we think are incredibly important for the people of Minnesota: protect the programs and the people who deliver those programs, and protect affordability. If the legislature is unable to provide $142 million, as I mentioned earlier, we will go back to our student associations, to our faculty, to our staff, and to our board, and figure out how it is we're going to adjust to a reality which is less than an appropriation of $142 million, recognizing we need to protect programs, we need to protect our people, and we need to protect affordability. And we will not be putting a proposal out until we've come up with consultation. That's a pledge we made. We came here together. We came to the 142 proposal with everybody being on the same page in agreement. And if we have to make adjustments, the pledge is we will talk to everybody and figure out how to make those adjustments, recognizing that we got to protect programs and affordability.
Representative O'Neill?
Thank you.
Okay. Chancellor, is it conceivable that in response to that, that we could likely see a slight increase in tuition? Would that be one of the alternative choices you'd have?
We have, Chair Nornes, we have all kinds of possibilities ahead of us, but I'm not going to begin to speculate about the probabilities of any of those possibilities, because that would violate the commitment I've made to students, faculty, staff, and our board.
I understand
that we're going to work together to solve this puzzle, and we hope you and your colleagues will be a party to that solution.
Right. I should not have said that.
I certainly hope, Chair Nornes, you weren't interpreting that as my scolding of you.
I have another question I needed to get to here. So, Representative Isaacson, you're next.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have, for the sake of time, I'll try to get through these as fast as I can. When the Commissioner Pogemiller came in and we talked about projected enrollment, they said that they had heard from you guys that it was about a 1% decrease. And I'm hearing you say it's about a 3 or 3.5% decrease. And when I've talked to various unnamed presidents of different schools you have, they're pretty convinced it's an 8 to 10% decrease. All decrease. If I said increase, I meant decreases in all single, every single time. And so I think what my concern is that having been firsthand and watched classes disappear and teaching at one of the institutions, I feel like every year I'm hearing that this is where we think it's going to trough, right? This is where it's going to level out, and every year we're surprised by it not leveling out. And and I think my concern is that when I look at the budget you're proposing, you know, obviously part of the math is based on tuition, and what are we doing to make sure we're not going to get caught again in this, and why am I hearing so many different numbers? And I know you can't speak for what some people you don't know told me, but it's people that are engaged in this process and are very knowledgeable are telling me numbers that are much different than what I'm hearing here today. And I'm not sure that I share your optimism that we're reaching a point in which we're going to stop, the decrease is going to stop. And so I think I'd like to hear an answer on that, and then I have two more.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Kane.
And thank you, Representative. Let me, someone handed me the enrollment sheet that I couldn't find. So let me, first of all, remembering that we have 264,000 students, 138,000 FYE in 2015. We're a very large system. So we have some colleges that have grown 30%, mm-hmm. some that have grown 5%. Some that have declined 15%, some that have declined 2%. So when you hear us talk, we will talk about the bottom line trends.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening in total across all the colleges and all the universities from year to year. It's very likely that you're hearing different numbers talking to different campus people because the numbers are different from one campus to the next. What you hear from us is just the total bottom line number. And what that number now looks like when we add up everybody's projection is, I said 3.6 earlier in from fiscal 14 to fiscal 15. I was a year off. It was 3.6 from fiscal 13 to fiscal 14. The projection from 14 to 15 is a 4% decline.
And if you parcel,
Representative Isaac,
thank you. If you parcel out and look at your 2 years versus your 4 years, how does that change?
I don't have that right in front of me, but I will tell you that both the increase and the decrease in the two-year schools has been sharper than the increase and the decrease in the universities. The universities from fiscal 03 to fiscal 15 are essentially flat, 54,000 FYE in 2003 and 53,500 FYE in 2014. The colleges went from 78,000 to 99,000 back to 85,000. So that's a lot of sense to that because the colleges are where the tie-in to the labor market is most sharp. But in total terms, you'll hear numbers from us across all the colleges and universities. When you talk to individual colleges and universities, you'll hear different numbers. As to Commissioner Pogemiller's remark, that probably had to do with the forecasting for the state grant program. And if he said that they're assuming a 1% change in our enrollment from fiscal 15 to fiscal 16, we've got a 1.3% assumption in our total. So that sounds like the same number to me.
Representative Isaacson, again, one more question.
Sorry, it's going to be a moment. So the second question on that is you said that you thought in 15 that would probably flatten out and not decrease. Did I hear that correctly, or what did you say?
Fiscal 16. Mr. Chair, Representative, our outlook from 15 to 16 is a 1% decline. That's after some years where we had 3 and 4% declines. So that's what I mean by we think it's leveling off.
Okay.
But you're right. These enrollment forecasts are simply forecasts.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Without getting us into a much longer discussion, I want to also take a step back to the question of nimbleness that we were discussing earlier, and this idea of how you're able to reach programs that benefit your surrounding communities. And I think that, honestly, one of the biggest problems you have is that the bureaucracy itself is set up and predicated on certain financial assumptions, like a per credit model for payment. And it's set up on an academic assumption of somewhat of how the liberal arts or a four-year traditional college works. And then you have this kind of outlier, in my opinion, from what I've seen from traditional college, where you're looking at the community colleges that provide much more of a tech or trade approach that tends to be a little bit more closely associated with its business, with the business world. But for some reason, still seems to be under the rubric of assessment based on the four-year schools more. And I know you guys have been making some attempts to break away from that. And Chancellor, you and I have personally spoken about this before. But I think that I wrote a bill 2 years ago that took a stab at solving this problem by just not having the per credit model the way in which you at four different schools for a customized training program, where we just funded the professor and the professor's job was to go out and manage the relationships with the schools and customized training. And I just, maybe now isn't the time to ask a question again in this debate, but I hope that you'll consider how we might go down that road in the future. And I realize part of that would require buy-in from us and the way we fund you guys as well. And I'm probably more of an advocate for that than many other on this committee, but I think that is one way to, take Minsky and give you the nimbleness to actually go out and reach into the community when you're not bound by the classroom size, especially when you're looking at your relationship with the business world. I think that's really a different animal than the academic world, and putting those two together doesn't always mix very well. And finally, I have to comment on one last thing, and I'll be done. Thank you for your indulgence, sir. this idea of counselors in the school, he asked you a pretty direct question, and you gave an answer of what we're going to do, kind of vaguely acknowledging that there wasn't maybe where we want to be right now. And I can't impress it upon you enough my experience on the front line of teaching students and the number of kids I spend a lot of my own time on counseling them through their coursework and what they need to do to graduate, because they're just not getting that support elsewhere. And I think that I can't tell you enough that how short I think we're falling in that area. And I know there's been a movement in higher education to kind of move away from that and make it more degree specific. But when you're looking at it at a community college, where a lot of these students coming in don't have the same norms or expectations that you see at a four-year school where you're a freshman and you have a track kind of that you're going through, you know, we absolutely need more people that have a better or broader understanding of what they might want to do, what does it mean to experiment with your classes, what does that cost you when you experiment with classes, versus what the benefits are of trying different things out, and really walking them through from a beginning to an end so they see this. I know that a paperwork exists, I know there are some folks there that can talk to them about this, but we really don't impress upon them what it's like to think about graduation day on their first day of school. And I think that's something we really need to be thinking about in the way we work with these students, because when they come to me and they don't really understand something or they're trying to figure out where they should go and what they should do, the way our system's set up now doesn't provide for a personal relationship in any level or any type of way we can help these folks who are already intimidated by a process and an administration, who are already intimidated by a school that aren't feeling the confidence to go in and just start asking more important questions about their future. And so I hope you'll just take that. I'm not saying that's an indictment of you guys in any particular way. I'm just saying that I hope that when that report comes out that you're talking about that addresses this, that we adequately provide that kind of support. Otherwise, we will continue to flail about with that particular student population, which in the community colleges is a really large portion of it. So, sorry, I could go on for way too long.
With that commentary, I think we'll probably be at the end of our time, unless you have some.
Okay. No, we just are very grateful for the conversation.
I want to opportunity. Say thank you to the Chancellor and Ms. King and others that testified today. Very informative, very helpful. Before you leave, members, we have a reminder that Minsky will be back again tomorrow, along with the University of Minnesota, talking about performance metrics. So stay tuned. With that, we're adjourned.
Chair.